This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. A defiant U.S. President Joe Biden rejected blame Monday for chaotic scenes of Afghans clinging to U.S. military planes in Kabul in a desperate bid to flee their home country after the Taliban's easy victory over an Afghan military that America and NATO allies had spent two decades trying to build. At the White House, Biden called the anguish of trapped Afghan civilians gut-wrenching and conceded the Taliban had achieved a much faster takeover of the country than his administration had expected. The U.S. rushed in troops to protect its own evacuating diplomats and others at the Kabul airport. But the president expressed no second thoughts about his decision to stick by the U.S. commitment formulated during the Trump administration to end America's longest war, no matter what. When briefing the emergency session on the Afghanistan issue, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for united efforts from the international community in offering the Afghan people humanitarian support and securing their basic human rights. He said, "I appeal to the Security Council and international community as a whole to stand together, to work together, and act together, use all the tools at its disposal to suppress the global terrorist threat in Afghanistan and guarantee that basic human rights will be respected." The swift Taliban takeover of Afghanistan has news organizations simultaneously trying to cover the story, protect their journalists and families, and help people who have done work for them over the past two decades. Video of chaotic scenes from the Kabul airport were frequently repeated during news reports of the fast-developing story on Monday, which President Joe Biden addressed in a speech to the nation. There is more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. This is VOA News. A hospital in southwestern Haiti, where a powerful earthquake flattened homes, shops, and older buildings over the weekend, was so overwhelmed with patients that many had to lie in patios, corridors, verandas, and hallways. Then a looming storm expected to bring heavy rains Monday night forced officials to relocate them as best they could given the hospital's poor conditions. Even those patients were somewhat fortunate. Haiti's Civil Protection Agency on Monday raised the death toll from Saturday's earthquake to 1,419 and the number injured to at least 6,000. Many of those people have had to wait under the burning heat, even on an airport tarmac, to get some type of help. Rescuers have recovered more bodies from the sites of severe flooding that devastated parts of northern Turkey. It brings the death toll there to at least 77. Torrential rains battered the country's northwestern Black Sea provinces on August 11th. It caused floods that demolished homes and bridges and swept away cars, blocked access to numerous roads as well. About 2,400 people were evacuated across the region amid the floods, with scores of them lifted to safety by helicopters. Many are being temporarily housed in student dormitories. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration is appealing a federal judge's order that blocked Biden's suspension of new oil and gas leases on federal land and waters. Louisiana-based federal judge issued the ruling in June, siding with Louisiana's attorney general and officials in 12 other states. Those states said that the administration bypassed bureaucratic steps required before such delays can be undertaken, and that the moratorium would cost the states money and jobs. The administration said Monday that the pause is needed because the leasing programs are responsible for significant greenhouse gas emissions. However, the statement said leasing would continue in accordance with the judge's order during the appeal. Spirit Airlines is now putting numbers on a damaging stretch of flight cancellations this summer. Spirit said Monday that it canceled more than 2,800 flights from July 30th to August 9th, and it cost the airline $50 million in lost revenue. Spirit says that the meltdown, along with a surge in COVID-19 cases, is causing more last-minute cancellations and softer bookings. As a result, Spirit says it will reduce its schedule for the rest of the third quarter, which ends September 30th. It blames the high number of canceled flights and on bad weather, airport staffing shortages, and crews being stranded far from their assigned flights. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia's president-elect promises to reunite the country.
The message really is onefold, is that let us honor our founding father, the fallen Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, who mooted the motto of One Zambia, One Nation.
Three people were killed and many students kidnapped in Nigeria's Zamfara state. Eswatini teachers demand the immediate closure of all schools in the country. The Taliban's swift takeover of Afghanistan raises concerns for countries like Somalia. And Malawi hosts the 41st SADC summit today, Tuesday.
We are trying to advance a regional agenda that brings the 60 members together. So, yes, by being member of SADC, Malawi benefit from the regional agenda.
And we'll speak with a World Health Organization representative about Ebola in Ivory Coast. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zambia's president-elect Hakainde Hichilema has promised to reunite the country under the One Zambia, One Nation motto. He made the comment in his first speech to the media after being declared winner of the August 12th election. Hichilema and his United Party for National Development, UPND Alliance, defeated incumbent President Edgar Lungu. Gary Nkombo, leader of the UPND Alliance representatives at the National Results Center, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the incoming administration will reform the Public Order Act.
So I must tell you now that there's going to be a breath of fresh air in this country because we mean well for the development of this country. This country is riddled with massive debt. Our first task is to look at that debt and see how we can restructure it in order to give some fiscal space for other sectors of the economy to start building.
Gary, the people of Zambia has reposed confidence in your party and by extension, President-elect Hakainde Hichilema. What should be the expectations of Zambians of him? Because he made promises to them.
We're dealing with a diligent human being who's a very structured way of working, of planning. And I can assure you that within this given period of 5 years, by the end of it, it's going to be showing some better economic indicators for this country. We have to determine how much damage, to what extent this economy is damaged. All we know from face value is that our currency has devalued. We know that the inflation is heightened. We are now yet to open the books and discover the extent of the damage of this economy. And only then can we make a master plan of how to rebuild this economy for it can benefit the most bottom people in our social structure.
A lot of ethnocentric issues came up. Tribalism, as Zambians call it. How does your party plan to tackle this? Because a lot of people I spoke with in Zambia are telling me one nation, one Zambia. What do you have for the people regarding these issues of ethnicity?
I wish to let you know that we have been the victims of this particular story of ethnicity and extraction. And because we have been the victims of it, we want to be the shining example of how we can embrace other people from different ethnic extractions. And an example has already been shown in the presidential running mate who is now the de facto vice president of this country, who comes from the north part of this country. And so this is a matter that we're going to neutralize in the fastest possible way.
What is your party's message to the people of Zambia after your leader was declared president-elect of the Republic of Zambia?
Well, the message really is onefold, is that let us honor our founding father, the fallen Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, who mooted the motto of One Zambia, One Nation. Because this country has over 73 ethnic groupings, he mooted that so that we live in a society that is void and blind of things such as what you are speaking about. We are going to truly revive that motto.
That was Gary Nkombo, leader of the UPND Alliance representatives at the National Results Center in Zambia. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty in the capital, Lusaka. Malawi's foreign minister says his country is happy that the regional group Southern African Development Community, SADC, decided to send troops to Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province, where Islamist insurgency has killed nearly 2,500 people. Eisenhower Mkaka says Malawi is happy that SADC chose to find a local solution to a local problem because, if kept unchecked, the Mozambique crisis has a potential to spill over into neighboring countries, thereby affecting SADC's agenda of regional development and integration. This comes as Malawi hosts the 41st summit of SADC today, Tuesday, and President Lazarus Chakwera will assume the chairmanship from Mozambique's Felipe Nyusi. Mkaka says about 10 heads of state are expected to attend the hybrid summit in person, while the rest will take part virtually. He says the summit will focus on regional integration and development.
We are trying to advance a regional agenda that brings the 16 members together. You are talking about developing the infrastructure regionally. You are talking about the rail. You are talking about the roads. You are talking about energy and other pieces of infrastructure. So, yes, by being member of SADC, Malawi stands to benefit from the regional agenda, which feeds on the three pillars.
Mr. Foreign Minister, this summit comes amid developments in some member countries. For example, the insurgency in Mozambique, the pro-democracy protest in Eswatini, and of course, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Let's start with Mozambique, where SADC has sent troops. What is the progress of the SADC mission in Mozambique?
You see, every trip begins with a step. And what has happened in Mozambique, for instance, these countries agreeing to send troops to help keep peace in Cabo Delgado, the northern part of Mozambique, is the first step towards restoring peace in that area. Now, you also need to look at what is happening from the regional context. If kept unchecked, it has got potential to spill over into other countries, and that would affect the regional integration agenda. There cannot be any meaningful development in terms of infrastructure. You cannot talk about industrialization if there is no peace within the region. So, yes, we are happy that these countries, the 16 countries, came together, agreed to come up with a local solution to the local problem.
What has been the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the SADC region? I know that the virus took the lives of some leaders from the region. What has been the impact?
Well, there has been some material impact on SADC because when you look at the GDP, it has contracted by close to 5%. You are talking about inflation because the industries have not produced enough, and therefore there is higher demand than supply. So, yes, we can feel the impact of COVID the secondary impact, because the primary impact is in the health sector, but then you're looking at what has happened as a secondary impact on the SADC region. So, yes, we felt the impact.
Mr. Foreign Minister, will the summit be virtual or in person? And how many leaders do you expect will attend?
This summit is hybrid. We are expecting close to 10 leaders to attend in person, and the others are connecting virtually.
Mr. Foreign Minister, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. We do appreciate it very much.
You are welcome.
Eisenhower Mkaka is Malawi's foreign minister. You are speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, the National Association of Teachers has called on the Ministry of Education and Training to immediately close all schools in the country until the COVID-19 third wave flattens to manageable levels and until the ongoing political unrest is addressed. More schools closed on Monday out of fear that they might be targeted if they continue to operate. This comes as arsonists have been burning down schools around the country. New Prime Minister Cleo Fast Dlamini has condemned the burning of schools, government offices, and health facilities, saying the perpetrators will be arrested and prosecuted. The protesters want to have a say in the election of their prime minister rather than the king appointing the prime minister. Bongwa Dlamini is president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers. He says the COVID-19 pandemic and ongoing political unrest have impacted the safety and health of students and teachers.
James, first of all, we would like to make it clear that here in Swaziland, we are facing a number of problems. In fact, we are in a serious crisis. One of them is the COVID-19, which is escalating in an unprecedented way. We are also having a problem of the political instability that is currently ongoing in the country. We have got a number of schools that have been burnt down, more especially during the night, such that we are also worried about the safety of our members from these people who burnt down the schools. And also, we are afraid of our members being infected by the COVID-19. We have got a number of our members who are currently infected, and some have died, unfortunately.
You said two things that are very important. First of all, the fact that there's been political uprising in the country, people have been protesting, and also the education aspect. So let's talk first about the political uprising, the protest. What do you make of the protest going on?
Yeah, in fact, for the past, I think, 2 months, people have been protesting, demanding political reforms in the country. Schools are also affected in that way, because some of the people feel like even schools should close down so that the government can adhere to their demand. And so now, they find that in the process, they feel like those teachers who are teaching are betraying the struggle. So in the process of trying to make sure that everyone is involved, therefore, they end up attacking schools so that even the students and teachers can join the struggle.
So you think that the arsonists, those who are burning down schools, are doing so to implicate the teachers?
Yes, in fact, they are targeting schools so that students and teachers may be released to support the struggle. In fact, maybe I should make myself clear, James, here. Our union is not as much as it is not a political party, but we support the call for democratic reforms in the country. Because as the union, we are not benefiting anything. We can't negotiate. The government is always adamant to give anything to the union because of the way this government behaves. It undermines the citizens. Therefore, as a union, when we try to negotiate for what the teachers should benefit, we always get a negative response from the government.
So in a way, the teachers support the idea that the schools are shut down. Is that correct?
At the moment, we have just issued a statement directing the government to close all the schools because our members are endangered by the prevailing circumstances, and also our learners are also being threatened.
So if you are concerned about the learners, why not keep the schools open? Because as the Prime Minister said, education is a critical driver for wealth creation and economic development in Eswatini.
Yes, true, but James, our understanding is that as much as education is a right, which will not be affected for the students. We also understand a fact that we should give priority to life first, because their life is in danger. We cannot expose them to the arsenic for the sake of education. We should make sure that they are safe first so that we can be able to teach them. In fact, teaching and learning is supposed to take place under a safe environment.
Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, James.
Bongwa Dlamini is president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers. You are speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 17. The Taliban's swift takeover of Afghanistan has raised concerns that it could boost other Islamist militant groups around the world, including in Somalia. The Al-Shabaab terrorist group has threatened stability in Somalia for the past 2 decades and once controlled much of the country. While an international security force fought back the militants, they plan to soon hand over security to Somali forces, which experts warn could see a repeat of what happened in Afghanistan. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
Former Somali intelligence official Absalam Gule says Somalia could see similar development unless the Somali government ends its overdependence on international troops. He spoke Monday, one day after pro-Al-Shabaab media outlets in Somalia celebrated the fall of Afghanistan government to the Taliban. Gule says that although Al-Shabaab does not possess the military power of the Taliban, he has no doubt nothing will stop them if they choose that path. In April, Somali armed forces assumed a lead role in their operations as laid out in Somalia Transitional Plan, approved by the government and African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM. The plan is a strategy in which AMISOM peacekeepers will gradually transfer security responsibilities to Somali security agencies before a pullout. The plan signed in 2018 includes a troop reduction. Last month, the military said more than 250 Al-Shabaab militants had been killed during Somali military operations and aided by AMISOM. Speaking during an interview with the local media, the Somali president's national security advisor, Ab Said Ali, strongly rejected any comparison of the security situations in Mogadishu and Kabul or the Somali military to Afghan forces. Al-Shabaab and the Taliban are not the same, regardless of the people's beliefs, adding that Somali armed forces are currently in control and responsible for security in most parts of the country with support from AMISOM peacekeepers. Al-Shabaab was pulled out of Mogadishu in 2011 by Somali and EU forces, but the group still conducts bombing, hit-and-run attacks. It has recently threatened to disrupt ongoing Somali elections, warning tribal delegates not to take part in the process. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Gunmen in Nigeria have killed at least 3 people and abducted 20, including students and staff, from an agricultural college in northwest Zamfara state. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja on the latest in a string of abductions.
School officials say those taken include 15 male students and 4 other people. However, authorities on Monday said 2 staff members and 1 of the kidnapped students escaped and returned to the school. They were kidnapped on Sunday night from the College of Agriculture in Bakura, Zamfara State, after armed men opened fire and killed the school's security guards. The Zamfara State Police Command has yet to make an official statement. This is the latest in the spate of kidnap-for-ransom attacks devastating schools in northern Nigeria. Emmanuel Huandi, a spokesperson for the Nigerian Teachers Union, says persistent attacks are partly due to the region's poor education system.
You'll see that most of those people that are doing such attacks, carrying out such attacks on schools, have no education. Apparently, they have been radicalized in this manner because they had no access to education.
Northern Nigeria has the lowest rates of school enrollment in the country. Over 70% of Nigeria's 13.2 million out-of-school children can be found here. Cultural and religious biases are believed to have influenced the low school turnouts. Last Friday, President Muhammadu Buhari returned from a 19-day trip to the UK, where he attended an education summit hosted by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. At the summit, Buhari promised to improve Nigeria's education financing by 50% over the next 2 years. But Huandi says accountability during execution of budget can be a problem.
We are beginning to feel that the funds government is putting into education, we have to interrogate this funding. Is the money actually going to provide adequate security? The government should begin to interrogate because so much has been put into security and so little is being achieved.
Since December, more than 1,000 students have been kidnapped from schools across northern Nigeria, and Amnesty International says hundreds of schools there have shut down as a result. Most of the students have been freed, usually after hefty payments or ransom. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
After the first case of Ebola in 25 years was reported in Ivory Coast over the weekend, contact tracing mechanisms and more were swiftly put into place in the economic capital, Abidjan. Dr. Jean-Marie Yamiogo, the World Health Organization representative in Guinea, who is in Abidjan to work on the newest case, spoke to Ricky Stryak.
We come out with more than 30 contact persons from this patient, and now including 3 family members and 6 health workers, health professionals. So that is what we have achieved so far. And now this is what we call the first line of contact. That meaning that the people at high risk of developing the symptoms because they were closer to the patient. And number 2 is the vaccination. We have started the vaccination with the high persons, including the health professionals in Abidjan and also the family members of the case. We have received 5,000 vaccine doses from Guinea, and that is why we are now using to speed up, you know, the immunization of the population in Cote d'Ivoire, in Abidjan. Number 3 is to raise the community awareness.
Can you talk a little bit about the treatment that is available? I know that in recent years there have been improvements on the treatability of the virus if it's gotten to within a quick time frame, I believe.
They are better now. They are far better now. There is a protocol, a WHO protocol, and we have received a kit of for the treatment for 50 patients that arrived yesterday. We have a very strong protocol, and when we applied it, the chance of survival is much higher. You are completely right, because we have standardized now the guidelines and the protocol of treatment, and the point is now to strictly respect the protocol from the first symptom up to we can declare that the patient is now has now recovered.
How important is it for Ivorian authorities to coordinate with Guinean authorities on this, because they believe the case came in from Guinea?
Yeah, yes, because we took it as a very, very, very national concern involving all the authorities, the meeting with the Prime Minister and also involving other ministries. Ivorian people are really, really much aware, and they are also confident that we have the logistics and the necessary support from WHO to quickly, address this issue. I think together with the engagement of those national authorities and other partners, WHO is not alone. We work with several partners like CDC, Atlanta, and also UNICEF, FAO, dealing with animal, sector. Together, build a national confidence, and we are sure that very quickly we can address the disease.
That was Dr. Jean-Marie Yamiogo, the World Health Organization representative in Guinea. You're speaking with Ricky Stryer from the Ivorian capital, Abidjan. And that's it for this Tuesday, August 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryer, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying have a good day.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
This is Haiti Adams, host of Straight Talk Africa. Join me to explore what is now and what is next for African society. culture, and politics. We'll go behind the headlines to analyze the news and emerging trends shaping Africa today. Straight Talk Africa, every Wednesday at 18:30 UTC. VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation. Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.